Welcome to Sirens of the Supernatural, Season 2, Episode 3, Deliver Us from Evil, an interview with Ralph Sarchi. Rhonda here, and we're starting things off a little differently this week because we feel we must disclose to you, the listener, that while recording, we did experience multiple interruptions that may or may not have been supernatural, and these included unexplained technical and audio interferences that forced us to postpone the recording not once, but twice. We had never experienced these kinds of issues previously or at any time we recorded or in between recordings. During the second attempt to record this episode, we not only experienced audio interruptions, but smoke alarms went off simultaneously in two of our houses in different states. Finally, on our third attempt, we just decided to keep recording so that you, our listeners, can hear and decide for yourselves if you think something was trying to prevent us from recording this episode. And because of this unexplainable phenomena, we feel the need to warn you to listen at your risk. And before we go into the interview, we also want listeners to be aware that this episode does contain sensitive topic information and language that may not be appropriate for young listeners, as well as religious and other views that may not reflect those of your hosts. Now, here's a clip that shares more info about our guest, Ralph Sarchi.
My name is Ralph Sarchi. I'm a retired New York City police sergeant. I'm not a paranormal investigator. I'm not a ghost hunter. I am a demonologist. I'm on a new kind of mission to help people.
There's something evil in this house.
An innocent family lives under constant attack. Fearing for their lives, they called me and my team to help.
I just heard a knock.
You heard a knock? From what direction?
You have at least one demonic spirit in this house.
You like to scratch people? You like to burn people?
We're dealing with something that is extremely evil, and it can affect your body.
You're a coward. You pick on innocent people. You okay? Look at me. You okay?
We're kicking off this episode with a guest you may have heard of before if you've seen the 2014 movie Deliver Us from Evil. It was inspired by some of his true life experiences, and he also had a TV series called The Demon Files and has been involved in some other projects. Ralph Sarchi, we are pleased to have you as our guest tonight. It's nice to meet you, and thank you for joining us. We'll let you introduce yourself, and then we have some questions we can hardly wait to ask. So can you give our listeners and viewers some info about yourself and your professional background?
A New York City police officer for 20 years. For some reason, everybody keeps shortchanging me to say 16. No, that's 16, 20. I did the full 20. I got involved in investigating cases of demonic possession and, demonic infestations. And, I worked with Ed and Lorraine Warren. My mentors were Father Malachy Martin and Bishop Robert McKenna. So, I have a pretty good, solid base of, people involved in this field way before I got involved in the field, the Warrens pioneers. Mm-hmm. In fact, they were chasing, spirit activity before I was even born.
Right. I'm sure that those names are familiar to our listeners. When you were on the force, you actually got involved with investigating some of those cases. Was that right away, or was that like 10 years in, or about what time frame was it?
Don't conflate the movie, with the reality.
Yes.
The job was just, that's what I did for a living. That mm-hmm. was my career. Every once in a while, I'd have some preternatural activity cross my path in my function as a police officer, but predominantly I worked, it was on my own, like I said, with Bishop McKenna and mm-hmm. Father Martin and the Warrens. And Hollywood just used it and, made a narrative It sounds a lot more interesting than my boring life, huh? So, you know, that's, blame Hollywood for that.
Hollywood does embellish.
Yeah, they do.
But it was a great movie. So thank you for sharing about your time on the force. Can you share a little bit about after your time as a New York cop?
I've been retired for 20 years now, actually. I went to Iraq for about 13 months in 2007 to 2008. I was a private contractor. I was training Iraqi policemen. Was actually an international police advisor.
Wow.
So that was a pretty good experience. And, you know, I heard a lot about the stories about the jinn, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, what the Muslims consider demonic. They call them the jinn. I heard stories about that. There was some outposts in Iraq and actually Afghanistan that the soldiers experienced, you know, supernatural, preternatural activity. But I never went there with that in mind. You know, it wasn't playtime for me. I was in the war zone. So I really had to keep myself, you know, mission oriented. There were some sites that I could have visited, but I would have needed to take a whole bunch of people. You know, I couldn't just mosey on out on my own. I'd have to involve the Marine Corps or the National Guard. So I didn't do any of that stuff. But, you know, I just, when I retired, I put myself headlong into investigating cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did take a break for a number of years, you know, in there. And I had every intention of retiring from the work. But Scott Derrickson and Paul Boardman and Sony had other ideas. So, you know, when I was notified that they were going to do they were looking into the movie, I knew I was going to be brought back into the work. And, you know, that's been doing ever since.
Mm-hmm. Neat. Thank you for sharing that background with us. I had no idea you'd been to Iraq. Interesting. That's an interesting piece.
I also delivered home heating oil, so, you know, I did all kinds of stuff. I was delivering food to Greek restaurants in Manhattan, you know, dealing with the traffic agents all day long, trying to give me summonses. So, I did a few things, yeah.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit with some questions that I know Ryan has. We're going to let him tackle some questions first.
Okay, and I appreciate that. And, that's good background. It's good to know the people we're talking to. I'm really glad that we're able to get through with this. This is our third attempt. We've had kind of unexplained technical issues on three different attempts. And this is, hopefully this one goes good. Not real sure the reason behind that. But, we've said some prayers and, did some things to try to make this happen. So I'm grateful you're here and everybody's able to talk. So with that being said, Ralph, you was in the police force and you mentioned, that some of the cases coincided with the cases that you're working on. I'm just kind of curious, was there anything like that growing up that kind of led you into it? Because, most people don't really get involved or really they react a certain way or not really think about these type of things. When was your first experience or when did you actually kind of come to realize this stuff is out there?
Well, I never really actually had an experience that I recognized as something supernatural. I was an avid reader when I was a kid from a young age, and I loved to read books about, war history, policemen, firemen. But I also, when I first started, I started to read about UFOs, UFOlogy, and reading those books sort of led me down the path into the spirit realm, because a lot of the books, they would conflate UFOs with spirit phenomenon when they write their stories. So I sort of veered away from the UFO-ology and more into the spiritual aspect, the human spirits, the ghosts. I was pretty young at that time. So, you know, when the demonic was introduced, I don't think that I really was able to grasp the gravity of what those spirits are. You know, it was when I got older, I eventually learned, but, you know, that's where I got my start. And I never stopped reading books on that subject, even into adulthood. You know, I was married. My first daughter was about a month old, and we had gone out to get some baby clothes in the, what the heck was the name of that mall out on the island? A huge mall. I can't remember the name of it. And I don't go by bookstores. You know, I go in, I have to go into a bookstore. I guess I have OCD or something, because I have to go in. And, you know, I went in there with my ex-wife and my little daughter. And it was my ex that came up to me with a book called Satan's Harvest, written by Ed and Lorraine Warren. So I purchased it, and I was on vacation at the time. So I was able to read that book in one day. You know, I remember laying on a couch and read that whole book. And by the time I was finished, I had made a decision that I was going to notify or contact the Warrens. And I did, you know. So it was from that moment that I got involved in the work. So there really wasn't anything external that hooked me into the work. I believe it was all, you know, my weird, you know, the things that I found weird is what brought me into into this field, actually. So you can consider me weird, you know.
We're weird too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we all are.
Yeah, I've been considered worse, so I'm not worried about it.
You know? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's interesting. I never knew that part either. I'm trying to come up with some things that maybe our listeners haven't heard before. You know, and you mentioned that your police work, you know, that it was on occasions that it might have coincided. When you was on a case, what made you kind of feel like, hey, there's something not normal? Like there's something a little bit more going on here.
When you mean case, what do you mean?
Like when you're on the police force. Yes.
Excuse me. Well, there wasn't anything outward. What had happened is a lot of the cops that I work with knew about my weirdness. So that's what we'll call weirdness. And I come in to work one morning. I was working day tours, and a lieutenant friend of mine, he just passed away not too long ago. He was a Buddhist, actually. You know, I wrote about him in Deliver Us From Evil. And he says, Ralph, come here. You got to hear this thing that they got. So to make a long story short, guy went to buy a washing machine in a used, you know, out of a storefront type of, if you could call that a storefront. It was an abandoned building, actually. And they, for some reason, they grabbed him and they tied him into a chair and they washed his feet. And they said they were going to remove his heart. So he broke out of it. He got out of it and he ran out. And as he ran out, one of the police cars was going by and they were able to arrest the two perpetrators. So being that it had some kind of occult overtones, the lieutenant, who was well aware of what I was involved with, we were friends, you know, he used to eat supper at my house, said, you got to go in on this. They got a search warrant. So I'm like, all right, you know, I'll do that. But in the meantime, we had back at that time, we had the assistant district attorneys actually responding to the precincts on, you know, certain types of crime. And this fit that criteria. So as we did the search warrant, and I found a knife, a blade that could have been used in ritualistic crimes. But that place was a condemned building. It was not like a livable. You couldn't go in and, you know, search through drawers. The place was loaded with garbage and rats and bugs and everything else. So as I'm talking to the assistant district attorney, she says to me, do you know anything about ghosts? And I says, well, yeah, you know, I have some knowledge of it. She says, well, my aunt is having a problem. And she told me some of the things, and I recognized some of the phenomenon I was being told as pretty much being the earmarks of the demonic. You know, that they're not, that was not performed by a human spirit. So I get, you know, I wrote about this in the book, you know, at length, the whole entire case. And I gave her one of my business cards. I had cards. And something told me to give her another one, and I gave it two. I said, you hold on to one and give this to your aunt. And when that woman eventually decided she was going to get around to calling me, she couldn't find the card that was given to her, you know. So she had to call her niece to get the number. And so something, there was a connection there that I needed to be involved in this particular case. So, you know, and that's the way it works. So that was just one of the ways that, you know, my job sort of crossed paths. I had a really interesting situation. We had a housing project. I believe it was called Albany Houses. It wasn't really a nice place. It wasn't a nice place to visit, let alone live. But when the elevators were being repaired, we would have to send a cop to that location to watch the repairman and his tools, or they would rob him and rob his tools. So wow. I'm standing there, and this, I believe it was Otis. I'm not 100% sure. He's repairing the elevator, and I'm standing right by the door, and we're conversing. And he says to me out of the blue, he says, you know, I'm renovating my house, he said, and I got a lot of weird things going on. My tools, they keep disappearing and then reappearing. I'm finding crosses in the walls. And so I'm saying to myself, this couldn't have fallen into my lap like this, you know. So I try to delicately tell this guy what I investigate, and I gave him my card. And I'm like, this, you know, this is an interesting Acadia. And because for some unknown reason, a lot of times people, they live in a home for 10, 15, 20 years, and everything is fine. And then they start to renovate the home, and then they seem to bring about a demonic infestation for some reason. And this has happened. This isn't just one or two incidences. This has happened repeatedly over the years, you know. And I remember talking about this with Ed Warren, because, you know, when I first got into the work, I was relying on his past experience to, you know, to bolster my own without actually having to go out there and get it myself. So, and one of these things came, you know, up, that renovated home seemed to bring out hauntings, and we don't know why. So I gave this guy my card, you know, and I never heard from him. So I often wonder, you know, what happened and what was the reason why this guy would tell, you know, a complete stranger about that, you know, and then find out that, wow, this guy knows something about it, and then never reach out to me. So, I mean, his tools were disappearing. He was blaming his kids. He'd go downstairs to work, and his tools would be missing. So he'd go upstairs to yell at his children, and when they denied that they touched him, he'd go back downstairs, and there they were. He said, this keeps happening to me. So I'm like, wow, you know, this is not a human spirit we're talking about. This is definitely diabolical, you know, in nature. And that was the end of it. So, you know, that's the way it works.
That's interesting. Like I said, it kind of crazy. You know, a lot of people don't tithe supernatural into that. They're just like, I know I just put it here. Where was it? You know, yeah. Like the 10 millimeter socket everybody loses, you know, or the extra sock. So, I mean, that's kind of crazy.
Well, it's designed to create confusion and doubt. Did that really happen? You know, it's not normal to see an object levitate in front of you, you know? So your first reaction is that actually happening? You know, but it does. And people, it's not, that's not supposed to happen.
Makes me not want to renovate my house.
Well, if you do, just give me a call and I'll come over and I'll help you out.
For sure. Ron, did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
Like I said, the major differences between demonic and ghost infestation, is there like a major difference that you can tell? And if you're in a room, can you feel something? Is it a sense that you get?
Well, that's a two-part question, but human spirits are not capable of manipulating heavy objects. You know, we're weak. We're weak by nature as far as the natural order that God instituted. We cannot affect the natural order that God instituted. And that's why this climate change crap is a hoax. We cannot in any way influence nature. You know, nature is governed by the angelic choirs. It's not governed by us. It's governed by God. But I don't want to get off the track here. Outside of our physicality, we don't have a lot of energy to move an object. It can't be done. You know, years ago, they spoke about psychokinesis, mm-hmm. you know, where people were trying to move objects with their minds. It's not happening. There isn't anybody that could do that on their, under their own power. Mm. We are electromagnetic energy. That's what we're made up of. Everything in this world is made up of electromagnetic energy. And that's how we the spirits manipulate our physical world, is through that energy. Now, we tried to recreate that electromagnetic energy. And the parapsychologist, but I don't know what year it was. I think it was in the 90s sometime. They created a machine that could lift a frog, levitate a frog. But this machine filled a whole entire room. This wasn't some little tiny thing that... It was a huge machine to lift a little frog. So my point is that we don't have enough electromagnetic energy to affect the physical world after we die. Now, the demonic, on the other hand, that's a totally different story. They do not need any of the energy from the natural order. They have it on their own. They'll use it if they can get it, but they don't need it. So therefore, they can lift very, very heavy objects. And just the phenomenon, a human spirit is not going to be able to scratch someone or bite somebody or pull their hair or pull them out of a chair, you know, or levitate the body. So that's one of the things that we could tell the type of spirit we're dealing with, is by the phenomenon. But that does not rule out the fact that human spirits might be present along with the demonic. I've had many cases where there were, human spirits as well as demonic spirits present at the location. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, they would ask for prayers. You know, when I did the demon files, I started to use all of those gadgets. I never did that back in the day. You know, I didn't use that stuff. And, you know, we found that we're getting human spirits asking us to pray for them, you know. So one of my investigators, Sean Austin, seems to be taking off in that direction. You know, he feels that it's his calling to try and help as many human spirits as possible. The ones that ask for prayers. So they get them when they ask for them. Now, the demonic, on the other hand, will never ask for a prayer. Never. Neither will a soul in hell ever ask for a prayer.
That's interesting. Like I said, right now, you know, I mean, that's some good stuff. I'm sure I might think of something later, but I don't want to take up all your time. I'm just excited to have you on here. Rhonda, you or Lindsay, have anything you guys want to ask Ralph, if it's okay?
I wanted to piggyback on, you mentioned the Demon Files, your TV show that UN, and I did get to watch a couple episodes of that. And if our listeners can hear the noise in the background, I just want to mention that's one of the things that has been happening as we've tried to record. So we're just going to keep on going. But on that show, so you and your team did differentiate between human spirits and demons. So does that mean that, I know poltergeist is a word that a lot of people throw around and use. Does that mean that all the poltergeists we hear about and that activity is demonic, moving things? And yeah, okay. Yeah.
I don't like the word poltergeist.
Right, right.
See, back in my day when I started, we didn't have paranormal investigators. We had parapsychologists. They looked at this from a scientific point of view.
Mm-hmm.
That parapsychologists were usually connected to the universities where they would get a research grant, and that's when they would start to manipulate or try to manipulate anything that they believed to be haunting, like a haunting, to find a scientific reason for it. So I use some of that scientific method in the Demon Files.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what else was it going to do? I had a show that surrounding this case. So I had a new dilemma. Normally I would do an interview, and it would either be an exorcism or no exorcism. Now I had to actually add an investigation into this case. And, you know, we used to do that with the Warrens. You know, we'd go in and we would do an investigation, meaning we would use tape recorders,
mm-hmm.
VHS, you know, those big, huge, lunky VHS cameras. And, you know, we didn't have Gauss meters and we didn't have the REM pods and the, you know, all of the gadgets that they got today to, you know, to try to measure spirit boxes and all of those things.
Right.
That didn't discount the fact that we didn't get them on our tape recordings, because we did, you know, we would get that type of phenomenon. It's called electronic voice phenomenon, EVP.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would just be an interview and an exorcism or not. So I had to throw that stuff in there for the Demon Files. And it was only mm-hmm. three cases I did. Mm-hmm. And the network didn't want me to pray.
Ah, really?
They wanted me to stop praying. And my producer said, "Are you kidding me? He's going to walk away if you make him do that, you know,
right.
if you force him to do that." And that's exactly right. And they knew this
mm-hmm.
before we started. I told them all to pound sand before we started. I didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to put up with their crap. I told them, "Listen, you're not dealing with Honey Boo Boo. I don't want to be on TV."
Right.
Know, I don't want money. I don't want fame. So what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I was going to, one of my questions was going to be, did you actually get to go in with the Warrens and do investigations? It sounds like you did do that. And you said you kind of looked to them as mentors. What was one of the things that you learned from them that stuck with you?
Well, you know, I learned a lot from Ed, but to be honest with you, I learned more of what not to do than what to do. Because, you know, the Warrens would accept anybody who wanted to come into the work. And that created difficulties, because a lot of the people that they were pulling in, they had no idea what their ulterior motives was. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to be investigating the case and I walk into a room and see three people sitting in the corner with a pendulum playing games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't go for that. You know, what are you doing? You know, but when I had my group of investigators, you know, because we started the New York City chapter to Ed and Lorraine's organization, which was called the New England Society for Psychic Research,
mm-hmm.
my partner Joe and I started the New York City chapter, and my investigators knew better than to do that, you know. And I told them many times, if I catch you doing anything outside of what I advise you to do,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be sitting outside waiting for us to finish, and that'll be the end of you. You're done. I don't want to hear, "I'm sorry." No, I'm sorry. No second chances. None of that. I take that very, very seriously. You know, not only could you wind up hurting yourself, but you can hurt the whole entire team that and the family that we're there to help mm-hmm. by playing games like that.
Yeah.
You know, so people just don't understand. You saged your house. Are you a pagan? Do you perform pagan practices? Because sage is a pagan practice. It's not a Christian practice. It's not a Catholic practice. We burn frankincense and myrrh.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you remember from scripture, that's exactly two of the gifts that were given to Jesus Christ when he was born in that stable, was frankincense and myrrh. And in the Catholic Church, frankincense is known to bring our prayers to heaven. And the myrrh is the myrrh of self-denial, meaning if you're going to pray, you have to self-deny somewhere mm-hmm. along the line. You know, because prayers are words, but self-denial is action.
Mm-hmm.
So God wants to see prayers and he wants to see action because we're physical and we're spiritual. So you pray spiritually, but what do you put into the game or the prayers, I should say, that's physical because of our duality. And that denial is usually through fasting. And that's why we perform the black fast before any solemn exorcism. It's a way of putting skin in the game,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. So that what we use is frankincense and myrrh that is actually blessed.
Mm-hmm.
Sage isn't going to do anything against the demonic. You can flavor your turkey with it. That's about all that you're going to do with it. You're not going to chase anything out by burning it.
Right.
We eat it, for God's sake. You know, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, can you give our listeners some kind of what you've learned about why demons can possess some people and not others? Like, what opens up the door for?
I can't answer that question simply because the devil and his demons cannot do anything that God does not allow them to do. So if somebody got possessed, then obviously God allowed them to get possessed.
Right. Like, did they somehow open themselves up to that?
I mean, sure. Playing with Ouija boards, tarot cards, satanic rituals, love spells, witchcraft, you name it. You know, voodoo, hoodoo, whodun, all of those pagan practices are doorways that invite the demonic into your life. Just simply cursing another person through words is enough to get a possession. Look at Maurice Theriault. His father cursed him and he got possessed. Of course, his father was possessed, but it was passed from the father into the son. And then you have cases like Annalise Michelle, where we have absolutely no idea why she got possessed. She should have never gotten possessed. She was extremely devout. She was a devout Catholic, prayed the rosary every day, received Holy Communion daily at Mass. There's no reason for that girl to have gotten possessed, with the one exception that God allowed it for whatever reasons. He allowed it to happen. Mm-hmm. That's the way God works. You know, we don't understand God's plan. And, you know, there's a joke going around that says, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. You know, we don't plan things. God plans them.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that we can do to protect ourselves from the demonic influences?
Yeah. I mean, for me as a traditional Catholic, I'm going to go to confession at least once a month. I'm going to receive the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ in the Holy Eucharist every Sunday and on all days of holy days of obligation. I'm going to pray my rosary daily. I'm going to utilize the sacramentals of holy water and the blessed incense. I'm going to use blessed oil and I'm going to protect myself in that manner. And that's the way a Catholic would be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. What if you're not Catholic and you're just out there listening to this thinking, wow, I've never been in a Catholic church. How do I protect myself or my family?
Well, and, you know, you're going to rely on the grace of God to keep you protected because, you know, therefore, by the grace of God, go I. Right. There isn't any one of us on this earth that is justified in his eyes for not only protection, but his graces that he gives in abundance. We don't deserve those things, but he gives them anyway out of love because he loves us. So he protects his children. You know, and I like to use human analogies. You know, if you have a parent, like a father, his child might be a drug addict. Is that father not going to love that kid? Is he going to love him any less because he's a drug addict, or is he going to do everything he can to help that child? Right. Well, it's the same thing with God. We, you know, that the drug addict probably stole and did all kinds of bad things and doesn't deserve the love that a parent would give, but he gives it anyway because of, you know, the necessary impulse of nature, which is for a parent to love their offspring, you know. And then there's a quirk in that where there are some that don't deserve the title of parent. They're anything but. As a matter of fact, they deserve to be as far away from that child as humanly possible, you know. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we are not justified in the eyes of God, not one of us. There was only two souls on this earth that were Jesus and the Blessed Mother and Saint Joseph. I mean, they all lived life according to the will of God, right down to the letter. But for the rest of us, we don't deserve anything, but he protects us because he loves us.
Thanks for sharing that. Lens, do you have, I'm sure you have some questions. You always have some good questions to throw in there too. And you know, just feel free to just go off the, you know, go off your gut, I guess.
Well, I was going to ask, so the movie Delivers from Evil, you said Hollywood kind of embellished some things. Could you talk a little bit about what was embellished versus the actual experience?
Well, I never murdered anybody. We can start there.
That's a good thing.
You know, and when I read the script, I had to do it. I did a double take, you know. I was like, what? So, you know, I sat down with Scott Derrickson and, you know, I had made mad. He says, oh, you know, they're probably going to change the title of the movie. And I got mad. I says, change the title? I said, look, you already made me a murderer. Now you're going to change the title, you know, to the. So, you know, it was things like that. I could never do an exorcism inside a New York City police precinct. Forget it. I'd have 50 million cops.
Yeah, I wonder about that.
They would have been hanging over each other through on that two-way mirror to see what the hell was going on in there. The captain probably would have came in and says, what the hell is this crap doing? So that wouldn't have happened. You know, we would have had to drag Mick Santino over to the chapel, you know, which wouldn't have sat very well after I had arrested him. But, you know, it's things like that. It was a narrative that needed to be, you know, created in order to tell the story. And he took a lot of the situations that, you know, I was dealing with in my cases and sort of, you know, like, I'll give you an example. The Abagnetti house where the lights kept blowing out, that was a real occurrence in my house. We were buying bulbs constantly. They kept blowing out all the time, you know. All right, granted, it was an old house, but the people upstairs weren't experiencing the same thing. It was just down in my house that was so Scott, you know, interwove that in to make, you know, the Abagnale House, Abagnale, whatever the hell he called him, you know, a little more spookier. Because, you know, imagine just sitting there, all of a sudden the light goes out, you know, and you're in darkness. It's not fun, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
So they, I'm assuming, sent you the script beforehand. Were you able to have any input as to changes for that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the script had been written by a few people. And one of the guys, David Ayer, I don't know if you saw the movie Training Day with Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke. It was about an L.A. cop. Very, very good movie. Well, they hired him to get the script after Scott and Paul Boardman. And I met with him for like a day. And then he went off somewhere doing something that I don't know what he was doing, but that was it. And when I got the script and I'm reading it, all of the radio jargon was from L.A. Rodeo 10. I'm like, what the hell is that? So I called Scott and I says, this ain't going to work. I says, we don't do. I says, I'm not an L.A. sheriff. What is, you know, I'm a New York City cop. He goes, well, rework it. So I'm like, okay, I will. And I redid everything. And you know the line where the character Sarchi was in the mental institution and he got bit and he was yelling at the doctor. And the doctor says, I'm on the phone with your captain. I'm about to talk to your captain. Well, the script called for, yeah, you're breaking my heart. But I said, I wouldn't have said that. I would have said, yeah, tell him I said hello, because I've actually used that line for real in real life. Whenever somebody would say to me, I'm going to call your captain, I would say, yeah, tell him I said hello. And I would walk away, you know, like, I don't give a shit you're going to talk to my captain. So the funniest thing was at the screening, my cousin was there. And when that line happened, you couldn't shut her up from laughing. She just kept laughing. I didn't want to smack her. But she says, oh, my God, that sounds just like you. I said, yeah, because I wrote it, you know.
yeah, I put that in there.
I should have gotten credit for a writer, because it did change some of the lines. But all of that, and you know, we got an actual NYPD dispatcher to do those parts for those scenes where there was a dispatcher. She wound up actually becoming a New York City police officer and became a sergeant. And I was sitting in a trailer with her, an open trailer with her and Scott. And she was feeding the lines and they were in the car. You know, the car was on a trailer. We were looking right at them. We were watching them.
That's cool.
And, you know, she's reading the lines and their answer responding to it. So, you know, there were some things. And, you know, a lot of times the writers, they're not 100%, you know, so, you know, I just tweaked some of the things for Scott, and I was a consultant, and I wanted the NYPD stuff to be tight. I wanted it to be 100% authentic, and that's what my job was, you know. So I worked with the prop guy predominantly, getting all the reports. Those are all legitimate NYPD reports, you know, whatever showed up. And the locker that Nadler was in, that I put that locker together the way a real police locker was set up. So, you know, we're trying to make it authentic.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask if the part in the movie for your daughter experience, or the character's daughter experiences, some supernatural things, did that really happen or something similar?
No, that was totally embellished. But there were a lot of instances that I had written about, you know, in the book, of, you know, my ex-wife and my daughters, both of them, Christina and Daniela, experiencing preternatural activity while I was out on a case or at work, or, you know, so there was a lot of stuff over the years. My poor little one was in the room when a picture frame came off the wall and flew across the room. It frightened her very much. Mm-hmm. Christina saw a black shape hovering over the crib, you know, of Daniela. You know, now my kids weren't alarmists. They liked the Little Mermaid and they liked the 101 Dalmatians. I seen that. Those two things, I know them verbatim. You know, I had to watch them so much. But that's what they did. They were little girls. They played with their dolls and their toys. And they shouldn't have been burdened with the spirit world at that particular time. But, you know, I know that little kids, they might be playing, but they got one ear tuned into what's going on with the adults. I know that because I was a kid. You know, for self-preservation, you got to know what's happening with the adults, you know.
Right.
So if I'm on the phone with a case and they're hearing, you know, your washing machine moved across the floor? Oh, you know, okay, what else? You know, they're hearing this stuff. And I guess in their young minds, they couldn't really put it together like I couldn't when I was younger, but they both know about it now.
Mm-hmm.
They saw it. They experienced it, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. And listeners, if you can hear the background noises, we have never experienced that on any other record. So we're sorry for those. The producer's been using the same platform for 2 years, and he's never experienced it before. So anyway, Lindsay, I'm going to let you continue. Just want to apologize for the background.
So you worked with Ed and Lorraine Warren, and most people that are interested in the supernatural know those names. What is your best, I guess, memory from working with them?
Oh, I have an awful lot of memories of Warren's. The one memory that I really stands out is we had celebrated Thanksgiving with them. One Thanksgiving, my daughter Christina, she was very young, maybe a few years old. Daniela wasn't even born at the time, so we had gone up to Connecticut and spent Thanksgiving with the Warrens, and we were late because we had a lot of traffic, and Ed refused to start eating until we got there. So we kept him behind schedule for about an hour. We were about an hour late, but he said, "I'm not eating until Ralph gets here." So, you know, that was more on like a personal note. I spent time with Ed. You know, Ed would call me and say, "Listen, I'm going to be alone for the weekend. Are you available?" And I says, "Well, I am now, you know. I'll be up there Saturday." And I'd go up there and, you know, we would go out someplace. Ed would take me to a location of some of the cases that he wrote about in The Demonologist, which I read when I was a kid, you know. We went to Dudleytown one day. I know, and I'm pretty sure you're familiar with Dudleytown. You can't get in there now. If you go anywhere near Dudleytown, they arrest you. But I've been there quite a few times. I have video. You know, I guess it was those times that it was just Ed and I together. And you know, I can talk to him because when we had the group around, everybody was always vying for attention, you know, wanting to ask somebody a question and, you know, who's goofing off over there. And, you know, but we had a lot of fun. We laughed a lot. I used to tease a lot of guys, you know, over the years, people get to you and they're like, "Ralph, you know, I was up there. I never remember you being there." I said, "Well, that's because I was on the A team and you were on the B team. So we never mixed, you know, we never mixed, you know."
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of people that I ran into over the years that, you know, work with the Warrens for whatever amount of time. And, you know, it was just Ed had a sign over his door in the basement that said, sit long, talk much. You know, there was nothing better than having a fresh pot of coffee on. And you got about three or four guys with a common goal, you know, sitting around talking, you know, about the work or whatever it is, life experiences. And that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. I don't have that anymore. You know, everybody's gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there isn't anybody really from the old school that's around anymore that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, if you can, speak a little bit about, as far as the exorcisms that you have helped with, maybe the most intense or scary moment to you that you've had so far?
Well, there was one particular case. It was an ongoing case for quite a number of years. And it was a very, very dangerous one because over the years, this particular person had worked with a couple of different exorcists from different religious denominations. And a lot of those clergymen that got involved wound up getting hurt, you know, in some way. One disappeared. They couldn't find them. Another one suffered a heart attack just before the exorcism was, you know, they were going to schedule it or scheduled it. He had a heart attack. And another one, his mother died. So the things surrounding this particular situation, I had about three or four audio tapes of this person's exorcism. And I never played them simply because the exorcism, they were never successful. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with the demonic, if you give them recognition, you can draw them to you. And that was the last thing I wanted to do, especially from a case that was not resolved. It was still ongoing. But we had set up a 3-day exorcism for this person. And I had a couple of my investigators that were going to be joining us for this exorcism. And I needed them to have some type of knowledge on what they were going to experience. So I put the tapes on. I let them hear some of them. And my ex-wife had taken my daughters out to the movies while I had my class. Which was in the basement. She did that often. When I had my classes once a month, she'd take the kids out because they make a lot of noise. When the class was over, I went upstairs and my front door was wide open. You know, I have a dog in the house. I have guns in my house, but my front door was wide open. Now, I know she didn't leave it open. You know, she's going to lock the door. So little things like that. You know, with this particular case. But when we got to the exorcism, it was a 3-day exorcism. And the last exorcism was going to be September 14th, which is the Feast of the Cross, the Holy Cross in the Catholic Church. We celebrate the cross of Christ on that day. And in that church that day for that exorcism, we had 3 relics of the True Cross. I have a relic of the True Cross. Joe Forrester had a relic of the True Cross. And Bishop McKenna had a relic of the True Cross around his pectoral crucifix. It was embedded in gold. And when he held the crucifix up in front of this person, I was sitting off in the rear to the side. And Joe was sitting next to me, which was directly behind the person. And when the bishop put the crucifix in front of her, I put it to the side. And I can see, I'm looking at, it was a female. I'm looking at her. And I could see the eyes. The head wouldn't turn. That look that I could see from the corner of those eyes, I've seen that on wild animals. That was not a human gaze that I was looking at. That was something different than a human being. And I sort of got a little too emotionally involved in it. You know, I was enjoying the fact that I was creating this fear in this demon. And it was actually, so for a number of years on September, on the month of that exorcism, I would suffer some kind of a major league problem in my life, whether I caused it or I didn't cause it. I was dealing with a lot of bad stuff in the month of September for many, many years. So to the fact where I, you know, I'd have the problem and I'm talking to my partner, Joe, and Joe would be like, Ralph, do you know what month it is? And I'd be like, oh, geez, you know, it was September. Now, you know, Joe is, we're in the middle of this and Joe is going to church. He's walking to mass with his wife and a tree branch just came crashing down and missed him by inches. So when I was at the same mass, I drove. I didn't walk. I drove there, even though I lived closer than he did. I had the kids, so we were driving. When mass was over, he says, "Hey, Ralph, you know, this is what happened." So I'm like, "Get in the car." We got in the car and we went over there. That was not a dry branch. That was a live green branch that seemed to have been torn from this tree. And thrown on top of Joe. It tried to get him, but it didn't happen. Now, this isn't the second time that something happened to Joe with an exorcism. He wasn't even involved in. He got hit by a car walking down the road because he set up an exorcism. He wasn't actually at it. So, there's a lot of these things that happen. And, you know, I guess... a lot of times it's the complete and utter violence that, you know, you're getting involved in with people that, you know, you have a 90-pound woman that's fighting for 45 minutes with eight big or bigger guys and not breaking a sweat over it. It sort of gives you pause as to, you know, what the hell's going on here, you know, and it's only by the grace of God that we're able to control these people. We're never tested to beyond the limits of our abilities. I've been at exorcisms where I was the only assistant, you know, and I would spend hours holding a person in a pew to the fact where, you know, I couldn't hold anything in my hands because I was holding on so tight. You know, with squeezing that I couldn't grasp anything for, a couple of hours because of that physical strain that I would have to go through. But I was never tested beyond my physical endurance.
So then I guess going off of like that was happening in September, do you feel like you've ever been followed after exorcisms by whatever you were dealing with?
No, I never had that. I very rarely had phenomenon take place in my house. It happened, but it was pretty rare. It wasn't an everyday occurrence. You know, this wasn't like, all right, once a month we have, it would, sometimes I would have two incidences within a close proximity, but it was most likely due to a case I was dealing with. You know, my dog got physically hit one night. You know, I wrote about this in the book. My ex was pregnant at the time and she was having a problem with bleeding. So I stopped taking all cases and I got one. They called on the phone and I was familiar with this woman. I had gotten involved, but then she had called me back and said, I have a priest that's going to handle it. And I'm like, great. Excellent. Thank God. You know, some priest is going to handle it. Good. Then I don't have to. She calls me back a couple months later and I let the machine take it. I was actually in the bathroom. I was getting ready to go to work. I was shaving at night, getting ready. My ex was on the couch and I heard, I actually heard my dog get struck and he started to growl. And I didn't know what happened. My kids would, you know, my daughter, Christina, would never whack the dog. You know, it wouldn't have been Jennifer doing that. And I heard it. So I went out and I'm like, what happened? So, Jennifer says he was going into the dining room and he got knocked to the side. It looked like something hit him. So I took that as a message, you know, not to get involved in that case. And I didn't. And I felt, you know, I felt bad about it, but I have to take care of my unborn and unbaptized baby, you know, the people around me. They're my first priority. So, you know, it's things of this nature. There was no reason for that to happen. It's never happened before. This dog, Max, was a lunatic of a dog. I mean, he would bark at anything except for one night when I needed him to bark. He was nowhere to be found. You know, he must have remembered the last time I got assaulted by this thing. I'm not barking, you know. So, you know, these things, they happen. And you have to understand that they do happen. If you're going to get involved in this type of work and you cross that line and you actually become a threat to the devil, he's going to know who you are and he's going to look to get you in whatever way he could possibly get you, usually through temptation. He wants you to fall and he wants you to fall in mortal sin. Because once you fall in mortal sin, he gets your soul for all eternity. That's not a really appetizing thought for me at this stage of my life. I fought him my whole entire life. I don't want to spend eternity with him. He's going to get revenge on me. I'm not happy about that. And you know, it's a bad situation because I'm not going to make it into heaven on my own. I know the only way I'm making it to heaven is if God miracles my ass in there, because I'm not doing it on my own, you know. Right. So I'm between a rock and a hard place, you know.
Ralph, how many exorcisms would you say you've been involved in?
Solemn exorcisms of people. Mm-hmm. I would put the number probably around 27, 28. But I've been at many, many more minor exorcisms, you know, for people that were being oppressed, mm-hmm. and possessed. There was a lot of those, you know, much more of those. Possession, while it's not as rare as you think, it's not as common as you think. You know, it doesn't happen a lot. And that's why when I get messages from people, I'm possessed. My first thought is, no, you're not. You know, you're going to have to prove it to me that you mm-hmm. are. You know, that's the way even though I might have a good idea that, all right, what you're telling me is making me believe that, yeah, you might be, you know, but then I hear a lot of things from people and, you know, just because you love to drink your beer doesn't mean that you're being bothered by the spirit of alcohol. That's a bunch of baloney, you know.
Yeah.
Have some responsibility for your life. Not everything negative that happens to you is brought about by the demonic.
Yeah.
It's brought about by the choices that you're making, mm-hmm. you know, and you're too narcissistic and perfect to believe that it's you. So you'll blame it on the demonic. You know, I don't go for that. God doesn't allow them to work that much in people's lives as far as possession. More on the inspiration, temptation field, that's a different story. There isn't any one of us that goes through life without being tempted by the devil. But you can also be tempted by God. Think about that for a while.
Yeah. So, on your, oh, go ahead, Lynn. Go ahead.
So do you, going off that, do you do, like when somebody comes to you and asks for your help, do you do any evaluations, like mental health evaluations before you agree, proceed?
Well, if it's a possession case, Oh, yeah, you're going to go and get a medical and a psychological makeup. And I'm going to want to see the reports on that. You know, I'll even speak. I'm more interested in the mental aspect. But if somebody is complaining about certain phenomenon, I want to make sure that it's not a medical reason for that to be happening. You know, people say, oh, you know, I woke up and I was paralyzed. Well, you know, that could be a medical problem and it could be a spiritual problem. So I'm going to have to make you go to the doctor and get, you know, a GI series, get checked out from head to toe. And then you're going to go and you're going to get a psychological makeup done, you know, and I'm going to want to see, you know, I'm going to be more interested in what the psychiatrist says than anything else. But then I'm also going to speak to the family members because not everybody in the house is going to be mentally ill, right? You know, hopefully. What kind of household is that? You know, but, you know, if I have a person claiming X, Y, and Z, well, I'm going to want to speak to the mother, the father, the sister, the brother, the auntie, whoever's there. What did you experience? How did you experience this? You know, did you experience it? Things of that nature. You know, it's an interview. You know, I take a police report, basically. I'm covering the bases on it.
So have you had to turn a lot of people down?
Well, I turn more people down than I would have taken.
Then do it,
Over the years. There are a lot of people that were mentally ill, you know, and you try to help them. I would try to help them. I want them, you see, there's a mental illness that fixates on persecution. Mm-hmm. And they feel that the devil is persecuting them. So what I want to try to do is I want to change the focus off the devil and put the focus on God. Now, there are some people that believe that God is punishing them. So, you know, it's difficult to deal with at times. But I would always rather them focus on God than focus on the devil. And, you know, you direct them towards the mental health professionals. You know, I've been trying for years to get a psychiatrist, you know, involved, somebody with a religious background, because back in the days, they were all atheists. They didn't believe in God. They believed in science. You know, they felt they had all the answers when they don't have. You know what? These scientists, they don't know half the crap that they don't know. They think they're brilliant. Oh, yeah, we know. No, you don't know, you know. So it's changed over the years where more and more psychiatrists, they would come from a Christian point of view. I don't know if you know who M. Scott Peck is. Nobody knows who M. Scott Peck is?
I don't think I've heard that name.
Well, M. Scott Peck is, he's a pretty well-known psychiatrist, but he's also a Protestant minister. Now, I was in M. Scott Peck's house with Bishop McKenna and Father Ramakumaswamy assisting them in an exorcism of two of M. Scott Peck's either a case or congregants. I don't remember. It was a husband and wife. It wasn't a possession case. It was an oppression case. And M. Scott Peck, who we called Scotty, you know, it's the weirdest thing, to see Bishop McKenna and Father Rama talking to, you know, M. Scott Peck, calling him Scotty, who's a Protestant minister. You know, they're traditional Catholics. We're traditional Catholics. I believe M. Scott Peck also was friends with Father Malachi Martin, because I know Father Rama and Father Martin were friends. Bishop McKenna and Father Martin spoke. So they all knew one another and they ran in these circles. So I got a call one day from Father Romer. He said, be up in Connecticut Saturday if you can make it. And I was up there. And he goes, we're going over to M. Scott Peck's house. And I'm like, wait a minute. The psychiatrist, he goes, yeah. Because I was familiar with him. I read some of his work. And you know, I got a chance to meet a lot of interesting people within the field of, you know, paranormal the paranormal field, I should say. you know, through being with the right people.
Mm-hmm. So that was my last question. Mom, if you have any more, or Ryan, do you have any more?
I did have a quick question. Like, after, if someone calls you for help after there's a mental evaluation, physical evaluation done, you determine that it is demonic activity. What's your process of going into either perform an exorcism on a person or in a home? Because I know on the Demon Files, there were some times when you expelled the demon from the actual home rather than a person. Can you tell us a little bit about your process once you determine that someone is demonically possessed or the home has a demonic presence in it?
Well, I'm not an exorcist, so I don't do solemn exorcisms. I'll exorcise a house.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Utilizing the Pope Leo XIII prayer and the sacramentals of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. properly blessed. But the exorcism of people, solemn exorcisms, has to be done by a clergyman, an ordained clergyman.
Okay.
You know, I believe that Father Martin had said that, you know, there are laymen that mm-hmm. can successfully exorcise, you know, people. And God has always used laymen to stand in the hedges, you know, when there were gaps in the hedge. If there was no clergyman available, he used a layman, you know, in much of the capacity that a layman could be utilized for his plan. But I'm not, you know, I'm not holy enough. I'm not going to undertake that. I've done on the fly stuff because it was happening in front of me. But I had a relic of the True Cross with me. The first thing I'm looking for when I speak to somebody is I want to know where they are spiritually in life. One of the first questions I'm going to ask is, are you baptized? And if you have children, are they baptized? Are you married? Is he baptized? She baptized? And if I get a negative answer, the first thing they have to do is they have to move towards getting baptized or getting their children. I'm not going to handle a case if there are people involved that are not baptized. Where is their protection?
I see.
There's no spiritual protection. So for the safety of everybody involved, the first thing you're going to have to do, and I'm involved in that right now, actually, I have a case, and there's mental illness involved in it, you know, diagnosed mental illness. There's no baptism involved, no church involved, every aspect of negativity that a family could travel down, I'm dealing with this particular family, and nobody's baptized. And I'm like, get them baptized. While nobody's picking up the phone, well, get in your car and go to the church and speak to a priest. You know, you have to do this. If nothing happens, we go no further until you do that. But if a person is baptized and everything is in order as far as spiritually, and I feel that the case is genuine, that it's a valid case of possession, well, I'll get in touch with one of the two priest exorcists that I work with, that I know. I don't assist them. They're in other states.
Right.
You know, I'm not traveling from Florida to California to assist in an exorcism. It's not happening, you know, unless it's Joe Biden, then I'll be there, you know, but a little levity. Okay, folks. But I'm not going to travel there. So what I do is I set it up and the priest, they do what they need to do. So they might have to travel, you know, you might have to travel. And if you're suffering enough, you'll travel.
With that being said, how do you know when your exorcism's been successful? I mean, is there a feeling, a sensation? How do you know?
They know. The people know. They'll tell us. You know, but just because they say it's gone doesn't mean that we take their word for it. We continue with the exorcism. You know, we'll see it through. And then when we stop, we'll, you know, we'll sit down and we'll start talking about how they know that. How's, you know, how do you know it's gone? And they say they can feel it. It's gone. It's no longer a part of them. You know, they feel free. They actually do feel free. You know, it's worse than being a captive, you know, in human form. It's worse than being in a jail cell. You, at least in that jail cell, you're still yourself. When they're possessed, they no longer have control over their physical body. They're no longer themselves, you know, and some don't remember. They black out. We're relying on family members to fill in those black spaces that these people go through. You know, they say, well, I don't remember what I did. And sometimes the blackouts could be for a short period of time to days long. They lose this time. They don't know what they've done within that time. So we try to get family members to fill in that area. Well, what were they doing? Well, they weren't themselves. You know, they were acting out. They were behaving inappropriately. You know, whatever it is, the nature of the demon, the way the demon attacks is the way the behavior will manifest itself. You know, if you have a demon that leans towards sexual sins, you're going to see a change in this person's sexual behavior, promiscuity, abnormal cravings. We used to have a guy in Brooklyn. He used to walk. He was a man. He used to walk around with a skirt on. And he used to have sex with lampposts. And when we would pull up in the police car, he would say, I got a problem. Oh, yeah, you do. But don't get electrocuted. And we would go because, you know, how many times are you going to bring this guy to the psych ward? You bring him there. They clean him up. They feed him. They let him out. He's back on the corner screwing lampposts in the skirt. This is what happens. You know, is it mental illness or is this possession? I don't know. I don't solicit cases. I don't walk around the street, grab people, you're possessed, let's go. It doesn't work like that. I know of many cases of people who I suspect to be possessed, then I won't say anything about it. I don't solicit cases. They need to come to me.
Hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I appreciate
there was a family that lived on Long Island, and they were on Ghost Hunters or something. And I found this out through the person that I was with, that they had this filmed in this house. And I would talk to them all the time. And I never not once said to them, hey, what do you have going on in your house? You know, all I know is that the light in the house that I was in, which was next door, used to respond to my commands. It would go on and off. And I'd say, go on. It'd go on. And I'd say, shut off. And it'd go off. And it would keep doing this, like right on command. So, of course, I break out the blessed incense and the holy water and the relic of the true cross. And I do the prayers of exorcism. Mm-hmm. So right back next door, does it go? But I never not once told those people who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't solicit cases. I'm just not going to do it. If mm-hmm. God wants me to be involved in that case, he'll make sure that I get involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Brian?
I'm good. Like I said, I mean, this is interesting. Of course, you know, I could talk forever, and I'm sure everybody else could, but I appreciate you spending the time with us. You know, I'm good. I appreciate you, and thank you for being our guest.
You want to do a part two?
If you would like to, we would love to have you.
I know that you would ask me, and you know, I would be willing. Just
okay.
Get in touch with me, and we'll set up another date. We could do a part two.
Okay, I appreciate that, Ralph.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us and sharing. It's been, you have an interesting story, an interesting life, and we've enjoyed talking with you. And viewers, we hope you've enjoyed it as well. Please send us your own experiences. You can email us at sirensofthesupernatural@gmail.com. And also give us a follow on social media. Check out our posts. Give us some likes and tune in. Keep tuning in. And we'll be back.
Don't forget to buy my book, too.
Oh, yes. I was going to say, I need to read the book. I've seen the movie, but I want to really read the book.
Oh, the book is 10 times better. Sorry, Scott, but it is, you know.
Okay, give us some information about your book. So hopefully our readers will go ahead and give you give you some love.
Sure.
If you would like to know more about Ralph Sarchi and his 20-plus year career as a demonologist, we encourage you to purchase his gripping memoir, Deliver Us From Evil. With a raw and unflinching narrative, Deliver Us From Evil offers a rare glimpse into the unseen world of exorcism and spiritual warfare. Ralph's relentless dedication to protecting the innocent and combating evil is both awe-inspiring and deeply moving. His firsthand experiences provide invaluable insights into the nature of evil and the power of faith. Whether you're a skeptic or a believer, this book will captivate you from start to finish. Brace yourself for a chilling ride as you delve into the pages and witness the triumph of light over darkness. Available now on Amazon.com or your favorite bookstore. For those of you who may not have time to read an entire book but still want to know more, you're in luck. Deliver Us From Evil is also a feature-length movie starring Eric Bana and directed by visionary filmmaker Scott Derrickson. This pulse-pounding thriller takes audiences on a terrifying journey into the heart of darkness. With its gripping storyline and hair-raising visuals, this movie will keep you on the edge of your seat until the very end. Brace yourself for an adrenaline-fueled ride as Sarchi battles malevolent spirits and uncovers a sinister conspiracy that threatens to unleash hell on Earth. If you're a fan of heart-pounding thrillers and supernatural mysteries, Deliver Us From Evil is a must-see. Prepare for a cinematic experience that will leave you breathless and questioning the very nature of evil. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Sirens of the Supernatural. Please be sure to join us each and every Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for a new episode. Until next time, take care and stay spooky.